seated. Good afternoon. We have a little sunshine out there. Not too bad, right? They say it's going to sleet on us, but I haven't seen it, so I'm hoping for the best. Okay, we are going to start our third case for the day. State versus Jackson. Ready to proceed? Please do.
My name is Andrew Hinkle. I'm from the Appellate Office of the Wisconsin State Public Defender. I represent Ms. Jackson. May it please the Court. There are three legal issues in this case, but they all revolve around one essential question. Assuming that we don't want agents of the government intentionally to violate our constitutional rights, what do we do about it? When government agents intentionally violate, say, your Miranda rights and extract involuntary confessions, that they can then use that information that they've gained to justify searching your house? Is it okay for them then to take you to the house, extract further information about exactly where the evidence that they seek is located? And if we don't think that's okay, do we care enough to try and prevent it? If the government seeks to use information obtained in the manner that I've just described, do we scrupulously require them to show not merely that they could have gotten the evidence some other lawful way, or that they might have, but that inevitably, that is, certainly, they would have? Beyond that, do we impose a deterrent so that there is no incentive for agents of the government to break the law on purpose in the first place? Or do we say, as the Court did in Nix versus Williams, that whatever we do, the highest value is that we make sure that the government never finds itself in a worse position for having broken the law on purpose than if it had followed the law? Is that what we call deterrence? Is that how we deter behavior that we don't want to see? If I'm arrested for stealing $1,000 and I find myself before the sentencing judge, does the judge say, "Well, Mr. Hinkle, we need you and the rest of society to understand that stealing is just not permissible. So, as punishment for that, you have to give $1,000 back. That'll teach you." I submit to this Court that that is not deterrence, and yet that's essentially the position that the state is advocating here. Now, turning to the specific legal issues, the first, with respect to the inevitable discovery doctrine, first I want to point out that although Knapp was discussed in both parties' briefs extensively, the rule that this Court announced in Knapp is not necessary for us to get to suppression of any fruits of the interrogation here. That's because under the federal law, as discussed in Chavez versus Martinez, which is 538 U.S. 760, any involuntary statement, which the Circuit Court found this to be, requires the suppression of fruits. The exclusionary rule for such derivative evidence is coextensive with the sort of exclusion that is called for in Castigar, which, as this Court knows, is a very robust rule of exclusion. It requires the government to show not only that there was some other route to the evidence, but that the route that they took was wholly divorced from the illegal compelled statements. I further note that the name of the inevitable discovery doctrine is a two-word name, and the first one is inevitable. And what that means is certain to happen. Now, the reason that we impose, that the courts impose, such a high burden on the government to show certainty is that, the reason that we're here arguing about what might have happened is because what actually happened is that the government broke the law, in this case on purpose, and therefore destroyed any opportunity they might have had to obtain the evidence lawfully.
The government broke the law intentionally and deliberately, failing to give Miranda warnings, right? I mean, is there any question about that's what the trial court held, right?
That's absolutely one of the holdings of the trial court.
And the trial court
expressed shock and amazement and awe that that happened, right?
That's correct.
Then there was a search application for a search warrant, and a search warrant was given, right?
That is also correct.
And part of the application for the search warrant related to the information illegally obtained by failing to give the Miranda warning, right?
That's correct. I would say that the information in the search warrant that was most damaging, most indicative of the problem was that which was obtained illegally.
The understanding is that there was information in the search warrant that was not traced to statements by the defendant that should have been suppressed.
That's also correct.
And my understanding of the law is that if a search warrant affidavit has good stuff in it and bad stuff in it, you can dissect the bad stuff, that is the illegally seized stuff. And if there's enough in the search warrant for perfectly valid grounds for search, the warrant is good, right?
That's correct. The warrant is valid.
Okay. So there was a valid warrant here, right?
Yes.
And they went to the house, right?
They did.
Under that warrant?
Yes.
Not once, not twice, but several times, right?
Yes, although the focus of this, the only issues on which we're technically before this court are those that happened during the first search.
Okay. And what did they find in the first search?
Well, the evidence that we're arguing about is a knife and some clothing with blood on it.
Okay, so they found a knife in the clothing on the basis of the legal search warrant, the legal parts of the search warrant, right?
I would disagree with that.
Okay, that's why I'm asking these questions, because I'm trying to isolate what the state and you were fighting about.
Certainly. What happened, factually, is that the police officers, at some point after having obtained this warrant, after having obtained these statements, were executing the warrant at Ms. Jackson's house. At some point after midnight, I think it was in the realm of 1:30 to 2:30 in the morning, they brought Ms. Jackson, still in custody, obviously, brought her to the house and obtained, she told them where to look for the evidence that they were looking for and that they did find.
Had she been Mirandized by then?
She had at that point been Mirandized. However, the trial court found that the Miranda warnings were insufficient under the case of Missouri v. Seibert to adequately, I guess, restore to her rights that she had already been given. If you watch the video of the interrogation, you can see that she's been interrogated for 5 hours after having asked to leave more than once and not being permitted to leave. And when it is finally time to read the Miranda warnings, the officer says, "Now, technically, before I talk to you anymore, I need to read these to you." And he goes through the warnings. And then the interrogation continues. She's already said much of the damaging things that she was going to say. So the circuit court found both that that was not a sufficient application of the Miranda warnings and also that her statements were involuntary.
Okay, but at 1:30 a.m., is she saying things that are illegal, that have to be suppressed?
Yes.
Under the doctrine that she needed another Miranda warning in the house?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
She's been Miranda. She's got a Miranda warning, right?
Correct.
Before 1:30 in the morning?
Yeah, sometime around.
So now they go to the house, and they ask her questions in the house, but they don't give her a second Miranda, right?
No.
Pardon me?
No, they don't.
All right. So what she says about an answer to their questions, can that be used against her?
No, it can't.
Okay. Well, what she says leads them to the evidence they're looking for, right?
That's correct.
So is that your point?
That is my point, that the evidence that they ultimately obtained was obtained as a direct result of the statements that were still in violation of Miranda and still involuntary.
Is it the first violation for Miranda or the second one? Is it the one that she said before they gave her Miranda, or is it one at 1:30 a.m.? Or doesn't it matter?
Well, I guess I would conceive of it as an ongoing Miranda violation. I think that the law in Missouri v. Seibert is that the two-step interrogation where the officers extract extract confessions before tossing in a Miranda warning and keeping on talking says that that is not in compliance with Miranda. And again, I stress, not only did the circuit court find that her statements were taken in violation of Miranda, but also that they were involuntary, that is, taken contrary to the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution.
The defendant was not feeling well at all.
No.
She was interviewed at the police station. But she was later given some medicine, is that right?
That's correct.
Where did that come from?
Those medicines were her medicines, is my understanding. It's a little bit, you know, you can't be perfectly clear. Some of the conversation is happening inside the interrogation room where it's recorded. There's additional conversation going on outside the interrogation room where we simply can't know what was said. I think at some point she was actually taken to her house where she took some medicine, and then there was another instance in which she was taking further medicine, and these are opiates.
She was taken to her house before the very late at night time?
That's correct, yes. There was an earlier trip to the house.
Didn't the deceased and the defendant have a child?
Pardon?
Didn't they have a child?
Yes, yes.
And the police interviewed that child?
That's correct.
What time?
Well, the interview went on over several hours with some breaks. I think they had a break for dinner. The time at which the child, and I think you're referring to RLDJ, the time that the child began to give the information that ended up in the warrant application, that is about how Ms. Jackson had been absent from the house and had returned and taken a shower and told the child not to tell anyone that she left the house. That information, there was testimony that that didn't come out until between 8 and 9 p.m., which is, perhaps coincidentally, about the same time that Ms. Jackson began to give incriminating statements as well. So it's important to know when we're talking about the third prong of the inevitable discovery doctrine. It's not the case that everything that's in the warrant besides her statements was known to the police before they began to violate her rights or before she began to give the incriminating information that also ended up in the warrant.
Okay. The Roadstar Motel, I often stay right across the highway from the Roadstar Motel, but I've never been there. Do they have video inside the motel to see if people come and go?
I'm certainly not aware one way or the other of that.
But there were people who saw who came and went.
Yes, someone did see someone go into the decedent's room and hear noises, and that's how the police were initially alerted.
Okay. Was a woman's voice heard in the room?
I believe that was the testimony, or that's what's in the complaint, that there was a man's voice and a woman's voice.
Okay. But that was pretty early on, wasn't it?
Certainly.
And that's in the search warrant application.
It is. That's one of the things in the search warrant application. No one knew who that woman was. There were no identifications. I think there was a hood pulled over the face.
But didn't the police learn that the deceased had come to the motel after arguments at home?
At some point they did learn that. I'm not exactly sure. I would have to check the record to see exactly where that information came from and when it became available.
But isn't that in the search warrant?
It is.
You're convinced that the search warrant is deficient if you take out all of the information obtained from the defendant.
Did you ask whether I believe it is deficient without the information?
Still deficient.
No, that's not our claim. Our claim is not about the validity of the search warrant, I think, from...
The search warrant was valid?
Yes. I believe it was a valid search warrant. The question is whether it was independent of the unlawful interrogation of Ms. Jackson. The second question is whether, even assuming that it meets all the elements of the inevitable discovery doctrine, whether the police ought to be able to take advantage of that doctrine where they've intentionally violated Ms. Jackson's rights. And specifically, the reason that, in my view, the inevitable discovery doctrine ought not to apply in this situation, again, a situation of intentional violation, is that it's simply not a deterrent to the police to have to give back that which they were never entitled to. The Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution forbids the use of compelled statements. It's not the exclusionary rule for the Fifth Amendment is not the same as that for the Fourth. It's not a judge-made rule. The police, when they came to the point of Ms. Jackson asking to leave, asking for the interrogation to be over, were never going to be able to get a usable statement. So why did they go ahead and compel it? Why did they go ahead and keep asking her questions rather than simply allowing her to assert her rights and to stop the interrogation? And I think the answer to that is that they had something to gain from doing so. Even if they were never, ever going to be able to use that those statements, they could, assuming that they could convince the court to apply the inevitable discovery doctrine in the way that the state wants to, they could use those statements to obtain evidence that's of, you know, great importance in this case, obviously.
The officer, I'm sorry, are you finished?
Yeah.
Please. I didn't mean to interrupt. Are you finished answering the question?
Yes.
Okay. The circuit court judge here seemed quite upset with the behavior of the officers in this case and made statements about finding the officers' testimony incredible.
That's correct.
What import does that finding have in terms of the third prong of the inevitable discovery rule, or even other prongs? That is, part of this depends on timing. When what happened, at what time? How broadly do we take the circuit court's finding of the officer's testimony, officers plural, testimony to be incredible, vis-a-vis the timing that was set forth by the officers?
Well, I suppose the first answer to that is that the officers, the testimony as to the timing is pretty scant and pretty, pretty vague, which, you know, the burden is on the state, and that's part of our argument. There was never any officer, anyone, who put the decision to seek the warrant prior to the prior to the unlawful interrogation or prior to the incriminating statement. However, with respect specifically to the judge's findings on credibility, I think the place in the transcript where you see that, it's the final hearing where he's making findings. And he says something along the lines that he found it incredible when the officers said that, or one or more officers said that at various times during the interrogation, they believed that Ms. Jackson was free to go, and that she would be of that belief as well. I think he was saying, again, it's not perfectly clear, but it appears to me that what he was saying is that if you look at this video, it's obvious that that can't be true and that can't have been what you were thinking. So I think that's really the only specific instance of credibility that the circuit court talks about. I mean, it's quite clear, as you say, that he was upset about this whole thing, but as to credibility, that's the only statement in the record that I'm aware of, at least.
So remind us of the three prongs under inevitable discovery.
The first is a statement I think that really sums up the entire thing, which is that the government has to show that it would have obtained, or sometimes it's phrased as a reasonable probability that they would have obtained the evidence but for the violation. Now, the second and third prong, again, I view as two sides of the same coin. One is that the government possessed the leads that would have led them by a lawful path to the evidence, and also that they were pursuing the investigation of those leads prior to their unlawful activities. And the reason that those prongs exist in our law is that they exist to provide assurance that the lawful path to the evidence that we're speculating about, that we're forced to speculate about, truly was independent of the constitutional violations, and also really would have inevitably led to the evidence that the government obtained illegally. That is, we require some prior pursuit because we don't want to be put in the situation that we are in here, where the government was pursuing unlawful means to get the evidence that they have gotten, and at some point along the line.
When you're finished, could I talk to you a little bit about the test? Because a number of people have referenced the three-prong test as if that's the gold standard and absolutely established in the law. Tell me where you see this court having adopted the three-prong test, and why it must be a three-prong test. When I look at Schwagler, Nix, Weber, it seems to me that the test is more of a, even though the police did something wrong that was in violation of a defendant's constitutional right, because the police would have inevitably discovered this as a result of a comprehensive search, that the inevitable discovery could be an exception to the exclusionary rule. To me, it's a little broader than saying there are three prongs. And then when you look at Schwagler and you look at its reliance on Cherry, Cherry actually made note of the fact that it's not three prongs always, but it's sort of this analysis that you have to undergo when considering things like these three prongs. So I hear some of my colleagues say three-prong test, it's in the law, it's in our precedent, it's always got to be that, and I'm not so sure it is, so I need you to talk to me about that.
Sure. I believe it was in Schwagler, where the Court of Appeals first...
Excuse me, my colleague's giving me a hard time.
I can wait.
I want to give you my full attention.
I think it was in Schwagler where the Court of Appeals first spoke of the three prongs, and for that they cited to Cherry, which is a federal Court of Appeals case.
But Cherry didn't really say it had to be all three prongs, right?
No, Cherry, I don't even know... I think they did sort of speak of the test in that way, but then you're correct. They did say later on there could be some cases in which this isn't necessary, particularly those kinds of cases where the lead that would have led to inevitable discovery comes about after the constitutional violation, which is not what we have here.
And then we have Nix and Weber.
Well, certainly Nix. Nix is quite vague, frankly. I mean, it's the first case in which the Supreme Court said that there was this exception to the exclusionary rule. Didn't really give a lot of guidance about how to apply it. So Cherry was one federal court's effort to craft a rule, which was adopted by the Court of Appeals in Schwagler, which, of course, doesn't bind this court, but it does bind me and my opponent here.
Hey, I just was trying to see where you were going on that.
Sure, and I would add, I don't think that the three-prong test is the only way to ensure, first of all, inevitability, and second of all, independence for the lawful means of discovery. I do think that in cases where that's not appropriate, the courts need to be quite scrupulous in making sure, imposing other, not necessarily tests, but simply looking at the facts on the ground. And I think in this case, again, the law enforcement officer's testimony, to the extent that they could say anything about when they started preparing the warrants or why, was quite vague and didn't meet what is the state's evidentiary burden.
Isn't the central question how we apply the balance that the exclusionary rule often requires when we have here a homicide by multiple attacks with a knife and unconstitutional conduct by law enforcement in part? Isn't the balance that we have to look at whether, as a whole, we are better to weigh in favor of punishing or preventing future violations like this, or are we to weigh more heavily using the information to further prosecution and conviction of a crime?
I certainly think those policy concerns inform the creation of the law and what the law is. I don't think that we can simply look at the seriousness of the crime and say, hey, all evidence is in regardless of whether it was obtained legally.
Right.
I would additionally say, I can see that my red light is on. May I continue? I would additionally say that I'm not standing here asking for an acquittal of Ms. Jackson. I'm simply asking that the government not be able to use evidence that it obtained unlawfully. And, of course, there is other evidence on which Ms. Jackson can be tried.
Thank you. But it will cost a new trial.
May I answer?
Pardon me?
May I answer?
You need further proceedings, right?
Oh, there will be further proceedings regardless. This is a free trial.
Right. But it depends on what you let in as evidence as to how, but the ease of the state's job is.
Certainly. It's a position that the government has put itself in here.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. I am Deputy Solicitor General Luke Berg, arguing on behalf of the state. The physical evidence in this case easily falls within the inevitable discovery doctrine in its current form, and excluding it will do little to nothing to deter future constitutional violations, even intentional ones. Jackson already received a remedy for the unlawful interrogation. Her confession will be suppressed. Anything more will be punitive. So this court should not modify the doctrine, but should affirm the Court of Appeals and allow the evidence in. Now, with respect to inevitability, it's hard to even imagine a scenario where the police don't find the knife and clothes in this case, given what they knew independent of Jackson's interrogation. Jackson's son told the police the following information: that Jackson was fighting with her spouse and that she got particularly angry on the day of the murder. There's motive. That she left the house around the time of the murder and was gone for 15 to 20 minutes. There's opportunity. That when she returned, she immediately showered and changed her clothes. There's suspicious activity. And that she told her son not to tell anyone she had been gone. There's a guilty conscience. The knife was missing, and given the violent nature of the crime, police had every reason to think that the clothes would be bloody. The first and most obvious place to search was Jackson's house, and the knife and clothes were in a garbage can in her garage. Now, the police started questioning Jackson's son at about 5 p.m. This is before they even started the interrogation of Jackson. So as soon as they started questioning Jackson's son, at that point, the discovery of the evidence became inevitable. He was going to tell them what he did, in fact, eventually tell them. And there was no possible way that the police would not search her house, given that now Jackson has conceded that the information that the police had from Jackson's son was sufficient for probable cause to get a warrant. So given all this, it's hard to imagine that the police would not have found the evidence.
Why did they take her back into the house at 1:30 if they had a search warrant and they were searching the house and therefore it's inevitable that they find it? Why did they bring her back in at 1:30 and ask her about where is the stuff?
Yes, they shouldn't have, because they would have eventually found it. They were doing an extremely thorough search. They had been searching for about an hour and a half. There was two groups. There were 6 to 7 police officers. And after an hour and a half, they hadn't gotten past the first upstairs room. So, they shouldn't have brought her to the house, but they did. And so now we have to decide whether they would have inevitably have discovered it anyway. And I think it's very clear that they would have, because they were doing an extremely thorough and systematic search.
Does it matter to your argument when the police were able to identify this additional information that came in part from the son and also the information that came from hotel employees?
Yes, it matters a great – well, no, it doesn't matter when they got the information from the son, because they started in questioning him at 5 p.m. before the interrogation of Jackson. So as soon as they started questioning him, that's the alternate line of investigation that made the discovery of the evidence inevitable. So I think he revealed the important information at 8 or 9 p.m., but that's irrelevant, because as soon as they started questioning him, it became inevitable.
Nix asserts that inevitable discovery involves no speculative elements. It focuses on demonstrated historical facts capable of ready verification. I heard you two argue that they were doing or would have done a very thorough search. Isn't that the type of speculative elements that we have to stay away from and rather just rest on demonstrated historical facts?
I don't think so, no, because remember, the knife and clothes were in a garbage can in the garage. It wasn't in a difficult place to find. The police all testified that they were searching every container in every room that they were in very thoroughly. One room had a whole lot of black garbage bags. They dumped them out one by one, looked through every item in the bag. And so I don't think it requires much, if any, speculation to claim that they would have found the evidence in the garbage can. It was just in a very obvious location.
It was in the house. Is that in the record?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay. So we had several rooms to go in the house, and then we go into the garage, and that's probably got a lot of stuff in it, too. So if it was an hour to an hour and a half in one room, got four rooms, you're up to about 5 hours in the garage, got 6 or 7 hours, and you're in the middle of the night, right?
Right. And you had 6 or 7 police officers who were all searching the various rooms. So the idea that they wouldn't have searched a garbage can in the garage is sort of hard to believe.
So they got more than one room done in an hour?
I think the first group was just barely finishing with the basement, and the second group was still in the first room that they started in when they brought Jackson to the house at 2:15 in the morning.
It's almost like you're arguing independent source rather than inevitable discovery.
Well, I don't think so, because the actual discovery of the knife and clothes was caused by her coming to the house. So we have to prove that it would have been discovered otherwise. Her interrogation was a but-for cause of the discovery of the knife. If it wasn't a but-for cause, then I think it would be an independent source argument. But
can I get you to bite on the three-prong, not three-prong analysis at all?
Yeah, I don't think you necessarily need a three-prong test. I think it can simply be the high-level question of, without the constitutional violation, would the police have discovered the evidence? The problem with that high-level question is that it has the possibility of swallowing the exclusionary rule in a particular context, and that context is warrantless searches. So police have argued in other cases that when they had probable cause to do a search but didn't get a warrant, the question of without the constitutional violation, well, what situation is that? Is that where they had gotten a warrant? If so, then you can see how it would swallow the rule. So the doctrine needs a way to deal with the problem of warrantless searches.
Well, jurisdictions can be split on that.
Sure, definitely. But the Fifth Circuit added that alternate line of investigation prong to deal with that particular problem. of warrantless searches so that the inevitable discovery doctrine doesn't swallow that, the warrant rule.
That's the third prong.
That's the third prong, yeah. And the second prong sort of, I think.
I don't know if you're familiar with this case called State versus Avery, but that addresses this issue also. And at paragraph 29, it states, in order for the inevitable discovery doctrine to apply, the state must demonstrate by the preponderance of the evidence that the tainted fruits inevitably would have been discovered. In doing so, it must prove, and then it sets forth the three prongs that we discussed, citing Sherry, the Fifth Circuit case that we were just talking
about. Yeah, Avery, Lopez, Schwegler, all three of those are courts of appeals cases that list those three prongs, but I don't think this court has ever officially adopted it. You've cited it a couple times in concurrences and dissents, but not, you've never officially adopted it. I don't know that you have to, but it's a helpful doctrine. It's worked for 30 years, and there's no reason to reject it here. So.
Rulings of the Court of Appeals that get published are presidential.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
We don't have to adopt it. We're bound by it unless we overturn it.
Right.
Just like one of our own cases, we're bound by it.
Right.
Unless we overturn it. So what would your answer be, that the three-prong test has been one that's been used in this state and it's never been overturned?
Yeah, that's right. And there's no reason to overturn it. Neither side's arguing. And I was just addressing with respect to the argument that you should layer on an intentional violation exception, the state believes you shouldn't do that because it won't do anything to further deterrence. And the reason has to do with the unique aspects of the inevitable discovery doctrine. The doctrine is the exception, not the rule, and police will rarely know in advance whether the doctrine will apply, so they don't really have the ability to game the doctrine to their advantage. When it does apply, the police have very little to gain because the only evidence that gets in under the doctrine is evidence that they would have had anyway. So there's no incentive to violate the Constitution in order to get the inevitable discovery doctrine. You don't get anything from it.
I reread Knapp coming in. And in Knapp, the bloody shirt evidence came directly as a result of the defendant being asked without a Miranda warning, what did he wear and where are the clothes? So there's appears to be a direct connection between the Miranda violation and the finding the clothes. And I didn't read anything about inevitable discovery. But one assumes that they would have searched his apartment and they would have had valid reason to search the apartment. He's a parolee or a probationer, etc. So they would have found it without that, right? I mean, it wouldn't be so hard to find his bloody clothes. They were really in plain view. They were in a pile of clothes. But Justice Butler, in writing Knapp, and Justice Crooks, in his concurrence, all of which were joined by a majority of the justices, there are long discussions that the police officers persist in deliberately violating Miranda and continuing the violation because they are looking for more evidence. That is, they are looking for physical evidence. And then sooner or later in this conversation with the defendant who has not received Miranda warning, the defendant is going to say something about the physical evidence, and then they can get it. And this physical evidence might very well have been inevitably discovered. But there are paragraphs after paragraphs by courts and by academic writers saying that that's why they continue these discussions way beyond where they have to and knowing and intentionally violating Miranda. So why doesn't that whole concept that
why they're talking so much to the defendant. Why isn't that a violation of Miranda, and that just bleeds out into any of the physical evidence discovered? I mean, that's what you get from some of the Knapp discussion. That's what I got from the Knapp discussion.
I think it ultimately comes back to deterrence. I think the inevitable discovery doctrine is unique in that it's the exception, not the rule, and so it's not a huge factor in police officers' decision-making process.
Yeah, but except that I just said to you that at least what's written here and the readings show it is a factor in the police officers questioning. It is a factor in their continuing to violate Miranda. You say it's not, but it appears as if it is.
Well, inevitable discovery wasn't at issue in Knapp.
I totally agree with you.
I think the court in that case wasn't considering the effect of deterrence.
I totally agree with you about that, too. But materials that are cited in Knapp do indicate that the reason the police continue the questioning, intentionally and deliberately, not giving them Miranda, is that they're hoping to fall on something.
I think there might be other cases, there might be other doctrines that police are hoping they can use, but inevitable discovery is not one that has any effect on the deterrence calculation.
Counsel, with respect to Knapp, if we're going down that road, I just need to make something real clear in my mind from Mr. Hinkle's perspective as well. Are you or opposing counsel in any way arguing that we ought to rely on the Wisconsin Constitution as part of our decision making here today, despite what the United States Supreme Court has said?
Yes. Jackson is arguing for a different rule than what the Supreme Court has set forth. So in Nix, the Supreme Court rejected the idea that intentionality matters, the intentionality of the violation matters.
Because in Knapp, that was a big part of that
right.
decision. Despite Patain coming down, the court decided, well, we hear what you say about what the United States Constitution calls for, but we want to follow the Wisconsin Constitution and provide greater protections. I just need to be clear if that's what counsel's arguing for us to do today, if counsel needs to argue for us to do that today, and what your response to that is so that we can be thorough on that issue.
Yes, that is what Jackson is arguing, that you should rely on the Wisconsin Constitution, and he has to rely on that because of Nix. We think that's wrong because we think state constitutional doctrine shouldn't deviate from federal constitutional doctrine unless there's a really good reason to do so, and we don't think that there is a good reason to do so in this case because under the reasoning of Nix, inevitable discovery just doesn't have that much of an effect on deterrence because it's an exception, not the rule.
How many states have said, we're not going to go along with that part of Nix?
There's three states that Jackson has cited in her brief. And this is actually an interesting point because the three states that imposed the requirement contra Nix did so to deal with that problem that I was talking about earlier of warrantless searches. And our doctrine actually deals with that problem in a different way. It deals with it via the third prong, the alternate line of investigation prong. So there's no need to impose these two separate layers on the inevitable discovery doctrine to deal with the same problem twice. It would sort of be redundant in that sense.
I just want to comment about one part of your argument and then have you revive my enthusiasm in your argument. The argument that you advance that does not resonate with me is that police, there's no reason to believe or there's no evidence. I think you stated differently. I think you stated that inevitable discovery has nothing to do with the police calculation in terms of constitutional violations such as the Miranda violation here. And when I first reviewed that argument, I thought to myself, in a rather fourth grade-ish sort of response, how do you know? And I look at the Knapp case on page 126, and there's some professor that, or I don't know if it's a professor, David A. Wollin, policing the police should Miranda violation bear fruit. And that's a full page of quote from this law review article in 1992, saying essentially the opposite of what you're saying. And I look at that and I say, how does he know? So I don't have a lot of weight that I give to either of those, because I don't know how you know and I don't know how he knows. So tell me why I should give any weight to yours. Please don't consider that. He disagrees with you and cites some stuff.
I think the facts of this case provide a great example. So if Jackson had dumped the knife and clothes in some random garbage can, or if she had thrown it into the river as she drove home, or she had buried it in her backyard maybe even, in any of those circumstances, the state wouldn't be able to argue inevitable discovery in this case. When the police officers initially asked her, where's the knife, and did it in an unconstitutional interrogation, they had no idea what the answer was going to be. If it was, it's in some other garbage can or it's in the river, then the evidence would be excluded and the police would have lost very valuable evidence that they might have discovered some other way. If it comes in, the only time it comes in is when they inevitably would have had it anyway, so they haven't gained anything. But they have a lot that they can potentially lose. So there's just no advantage to violating the Constitution hoping to get something out of the inevitable discovery doctrine, because there's little to gain through it.
Well, I don't know. The Court of Appeals has, in its decision here, not served as a deterrent effect to it, has it? And they've gained something. They got to use evidence, even though there was what the circuit court said really was a horrendous, well, I shouldn't put in for. In his years on the bench, he's never seen behavior like this by police officers. That's what he did say. And yet, you know, the inevitable discovery kind of takes care of any of that egregious behavior.
I think the point is that the police basically got lucky in this case, that the evidence was in such an obvious location. If it was in any number of other locations, it would be out. I also want to point out that there is a remedy that's already been applied. Everything that Jackson said is being suppressed, so she's already received a remedy. Anything beyond excluding the physical evidence would be punitive, and the purpose of the exclusionary rule is deterrence, not punishment. This is the exact reasoning that Nix relied on, that it wouldn't further deterrence to add this sort of intentional exception to the inevitable discovery doctrine. So,
I know I've written that several times.
Okay, so from a deterrence perspective, to sort of restate what you just said, at the time the police asked the questions and did so in an unconstitutional manner, while they had not yet found the murder weapon, they didn't know what the answer would be that came out of their mouth. And the answer just happened to be, or the direction just happened to be, it's at the house that you're already searching. But had they asked and continued in the unconstitutional way to inquire, and she said, it's in the woods, at the park, down the road, that would have been excluded because that was not an area that they were currently searching.
That's right, yeah. So the next time that a police officer is thinking about violating the Constitution, he or she should recognize that you could lose really valuable evidence.
They don't know.
Because they don't know in advance, right? They have no way of knowing in advance, right?
The evidence is.
Right.
So in your answer to Justice Gradley, part of your answer is, it's a deterrent because that's pretty high-risk behavior
to say, oh, I don't care about your constitutional rights because, and then fill in the blank.
Right.
Because they don't know if it's going to be a place they're already searching. Am I right, or did
right.
I miss something?
No, that's exactly right. So there's still a really high deterrent value, even if the inevitable discovery doctrine applies to this type of evidence. And that's just one side of the coin. The opposite side is the huge societal cost to excluding this evidence to victims' families, to future possible victims, to all the police officers who in the investigation didn't violate constitutional rights, and then perhaps most importantly, to truth and justice. So even if there's some tiny marginal added deterrent value, it doesn't outweigh the cost to society that is borne by excluding this evidence.
Counsel, is there any explanation that you could provide for what the police did here in terms of the Miranda violations?
Look, deterrence is not a panacea. It's not always going to work. The best you can hope for is that police will know the law, think about the law, plan their actions accordingly. But there's a lot of places that can fail. I don't know why the police violated her rights in this case. There's a lot of possibilities. Maybe they just were ignorant of the law. Maybe it was a mistake. There's a lot of possibilities. I don't know. The record doesn't say, but deterrence is never going to be perfect. So the fact that they violated her rights in this case, I don't think undermines the point that deterrence is still equally as strong, even if this evidence comes in.
Should this court be considering attempting to do something more to deter this kind of conduct?
No, I don't think so, because I think it's fully deterred. Even if you allow the evidence in this case, there's still just as much deterrence for all the reasons we've been talking about. The police in advance have no way of knowing whether this doctrine is going to apply. If it does apply, the only thing that they gain is something that they would have gotten anyway, so they haven't gained anything by it. But they still have a lot to lose. So I think punishing the police in this case is not going to add much to deterrence. I did a brief survey of cases over the last 10 years, seeing how many cases actually use the inevitable discovery exception, and there's only 10 that I could find in the Wisconsin Court of Appeals that allowed evidence in under the inevitable discovery doctrine. So I think that shows that this is the exception, not the rule.
How many cases do you define where is an intentional, deliberate violation of Miranda?
I wasn't looking for that, so I can't answer that.
Well, at least we know of two, Knapp and this one, right?
Yep.
I don't know if you know, I assume you do, David Perlman, who he's attached to the Department of Justice, isn't he, in standards, and he trains police officers. And I'm trying to think of how he would teach this case, should you prevail. I think he'd say that the court recognizes that intentional, deliberate failure to give somebody the Miranda is a no-no. You're going to get in trouble. Maybe not personal discipline, but the court's going to be unhappy about it and say that, right?
I think he would say, don't violate the Constitution because you're going to lose and have potential to lose really valuable evidence. At the very least, you'll lose the suppression, but you might lose a lot of physical evidence.
But you might not lose physical evidence, and you're not going to lose it in this case.
Yeah, there are rare exceptions where you won't lose it, but in most cases, you will.
Well, give me a case where it's lost, other than Knapp, which is a very different case.
Well, I think there's a lot of hypothetical examples that I've already given from this case. If she had dumped the evidence anywhere but her house.
Well, I watch a lot of TV detective things. I'm a sort of glutton for this kind of punishment. And if there's water anywhere near the scene of the crime or the house, the first thing they do is drag the river or the pond or whatever, because that's where people throw things. So I'm not so sure that that's so far-fetched. And the same thing goes to the yard. You go out with a metal detector, and if you're looking for a gun, it's not plastic. You go out and check the whole yard, and you dig it up if you have to, and find it. So I'm not persuaded that that's so far-fetched and that it's not within inevitable discovery. I think those are the places you look, the house, adjacent area.
That's true, but the doctrine has those two additional prongs that the police had to be pursuing an alternate line of investigation. So if it was in the river and they hadn't started searching the river and there's no line of investigation showing that they were going to search the river, then the doctrine doesn't apply. So the three prongs together make the doctrine very hard to meet, which is why it's an exception, not the rule. So I think the point stands. Yes. With respect to Jackson's argument that there was no alternate line of investigation, that's just wrong. At all points, there was an alternate line of investigation. Police were questioning Jackson's son at 5 p.m. That's the alternate line of investigation that started before they even began interrogating Jackson. So at all possible relevant times, there was an alternate line of investigation. To conclude,
to ask you about the questioning of the child, he's not a suspect, right? He's
right.
Just a potential witness. Do you have to worry about that he's questioned? Was an adult there with him?
No, he was alone in the room.
Any problems about that?
There's no argument in this case that there was. The trial court specifically found that there was no problem with the questioning of the son, and that it wasn't tainted in any way by the interrogation of Jackson. So, no, I don't think there's anything in the record that would show a problem with the way that they questioned her son. They asked him questions for an hour and a half, and then he took a break for dinner, ate with his brother. He was in a room with a TV, so he was watching TV when they were not questioning him. And then they came back, I think asked him questions for another half an hour, and that's when he told them all of the important information. Yeah.
Question.
Right.
But he was given the right to eat, et cetera. Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
So I think there's very little doubt in this case that the police would have discovered the evidence. It was in the primary suspect's garage in a garbage can. It's just hard to believe that they would not have looked there. And there's little to no deterrence to be gained by excluding the evidence. So you should affirm the Court of Appeals.
Why aren't you persuaded?
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about deterrence. First of all, I have to disagree with the state's sort of hypothetical example of, you know, what if the knife and clothing had been in the river or in a ditch or in the woods. I mean, there's two possibilities here, right? I mean, either it was in a place where they were going to look or it was in a place where they weren't. So in this instance, where it was in the house where they were looking, they find it. They say it would inevitably have been discovered, and it comes in. So no downside there for violating Ms. Jackson's constitutional rights. Say it's somewhere that they're not going to look. They never would have found it. They interrogate her, violate her constitutional rights. She tells them where it is. They find it. They can't use it, maybe, assuming that they can't find some doctrine that permits it to be introduced. But they couldn't have used it anyway if they hadn't found it. So where is there any deterrence from intentionally violating someone's constitutional rights in order to try and gain derivative physical evidence? There's only potential upside for the state. That is the opposite of a deterrent. State also says that we've already received a remedy. Ms. Jackson has already received a remedy because her statements are going to be suppressed. But again, the state was never, ever entitled to use those statements from the moment that they decided to seek them, despite her assertions or her request to leave. So if I try and get something that I'm not entitled to get and I don't get it, I can hardly say that I've been penalized or I've been punished enough, but that's the state's position here.
Well, to be fair to your opposing counsel, I thought he went out of his way to say that the purpose of the exclusionary rule is not punishment, but deterrence.
I agree. I mean, I don't think in a sense you can't really punish the state at all. But I would just substitute the word deterred for the word punishment.
Okay, well, how about this? The statements are excluded. So therefore, if law enforcement is deliberately violating somebody's constitutional right by not bringing them, can't use any statements as product of that. That is deterrence from doing that. What it seems to me is we're on a totally separate track, which is the inevitable discovery doctrine. And so I'm not you've mixed them. I've listened to you very carefully. And it seems to me that we're on separate tracks here. Are they going to drain Lake Mendota to look for the pistol? Are they going to dig up the yard and the neighbor's yard to look for whatever evidence? That's the real question when we're coming to inevitable. Or are they going to look in the garbage can in the garage? That's what we're talking about when we're talking about inevitable discovery. So it's a nice line, but I'm not sure how availing it is for you to say.
I would disagree.
They're not going to be punished. They're not going to be punished because that's not the purpose. They're going to be deterred from obtaining statements, which is the purpose.
And I disagree that they're going to be deterred from obtaining these statements because, again, this
is... What's the incentive? Let's look at it this way. You keep saying, what's the punishment? I ask you, what's the incentive?
The incentive is that they got physical evidence that they could use in this case against her.
But that's the whole question of this case.
Agreed.
Do you need to rely on the Wisconsin Constitution at all?
I would agree with counsel that I have to rely on it. We have to rely on it as far as the third issue. I would agree with counsel that Nix versus Williams says that intentionality is not the issue under the federal Constitution. I'd hasten to point out that the inevitable discovery isn't mentioned in any of the constitutions and that it's a judge-made rule and a policy judgment, one that this court is certainly free to make for Wisconsin differently than the United States Supreme Court has made for the federal Constitution. As to the first two issues, as to whether the inevitable discovery doctrine is satisfied, no. I believe, we're arguing under the federal and state constitutions.
Know that that the clothes would be in the house.
Do I think the police knew the clothes would be in the house? Well, certainly by the time Ms. Jackson told them where they were, told them the story of it.
Said, in effect, that when you heard a zipper, one assumes that she is taking off her clothes. She goes into a shower. She comes back wearing different clothes. All this is in a very short time. And so what did she do with the clothes?
I note again that my red light is on.
Yeah. You have the answer, that's right. So don't they know from the youngster? Clothes are really nearby the shower.
I think that certainly the youngster's information certainly did tend to suggest that the clothing would be in the house. I don't think it proves it. I'm not exactly sure what the record movements afterward.
Probable cause to search the house?
Again, our position has never been that there wasn't probable cause to search the house in the warrant, merely that her statements led to the discovery of the evidence.
Does it make any difference what time the son gave this evidence that was damaging to the defendant? There seems to be an overlap. The defendant started making incriminating statements about 8:30, and it's estimated sometime between 8 and 9, the son started doing that. It happened before the son's testimony, was before or after the incriminating statements began by the defendant, does that make any difference?
I think that it does make a difference with respect to the third prong. Once again, it was the state's obligation to show that the decision to seek the warrant was made before or was made independently of Ms. Jackson's statements, and the fact that they didn't have that information at the time that they began to gather her statements is an evidentiary problem for them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you both for very, very good arguments and a very interesting case. That concludes our argument for the day. The court will meet in closed conference at 10 minutes after 3:00.